You're listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Thank you all so much for joining us today. Kim Qatas is known to many of you as the BBC State Department correspondent. And when she told me a couple years ago that she was going to be writing a book about covering Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, I promised her that she had to do the book launch at Carnegie, which just seems like yesterday she made that promise. And I hoped she would write a good book, although I didn't tell her that. And she's gone way above and beyond expectations. Her book, which is going to be sold afterwards, is called The Secretary, A Journey with Hillary Clinton from Beirut to the Heart of American Power, is really a fantastic read. It's been endorsed by heavyweights, foreign policy heavyweights on both sides of the political spectrum. And most importantly for book sales, it's been endorsed by Oprah Magazine, which called it a page-turner. And it truly is a page-turner. I finished it over the weekend, and so I encourage all of you to have a look at that. So I'm very glad that Kim could join us today. And today, I think, is the official launch, right?
Yes.
The first event.
So you're the first.
The very first. So we're very proud to host her here at Carnegie. And I'm also very grateful to David Rothkopf, who is CEO and editor-in-large of Foreign Policy Magazine. And more importantly, he's a colleague of ours here at Carnegie. And David needs no introduction to any of you. He's one of the most prolific and insightful writers on Washington, who's written several books about power, NSC, American foreign policy, statecraft. So what I'd like to do is just have a conversation, moderate gently a conversation between Kim and David, and then I'll hand it over to all of you. And to start with, Kim, and if you can tell us a little bit about the book. So on one hand, it's the story of Hillary Clinton's tenure as Secretary of State. But you also weave Hillary's story together with your own personal story of growing up in war-torn Beirut. And there's a wonderful quote. The book actually opens with a quote from Kim's father, who says, quote, "If America wanted the fighting to end, the war would be over tomorrow." Now, he was talking about the Lebanese Civil War, but that quote can be applied to so many wars throughout the world. So many Iranians who will tell you that the Iran-Iraq war will end when the U.S. wants it to, in Afghanistan and Egypt and other contexts. So what is the story you're trying to tell here? It's Hillary's story. It's your personal story. Who is the audience you're trying to reach here?
Well, of course, I'm trying to reach all of you here in the room. So thank you, Karim, for having me, and thank you to David for agreeing to join us on this panel. I've been in the audience for the last 5 years as a State Department correspondent, so I'm delighted to have the opportunity to speak from the podium, and I thank you all for coming to listen. You make a great point, Karim, which is that this book is, of course, of interest to everyone who wants to know what Hillary Clinton has been doing at the State Department for the last 4 years. But I do bring a different perspective to the discussion of what is the role of an American Secretary of State and what is America's position on the global stage in the 21st century. And I come at it from my perspective, as Karim pointed out, which is that of a child of war, in essence. I was born in Beirut in the Civil War. I lived there my whole life until I came to Washington 5 years ago. So it really frames the discussion. It frames the writing that I bring to to this book. And the quote that Karim mentions about my father is indeed one that is a recurrent theme to this day. This isn't just something that I heard when I was young in Beirut, but that I continued hearing on my trips with the Secretary of State around the world, whether I was in Pakistan or China, you know, with variations. I mean, obviously in China, people aren't hoping for the United States necessarily to come in and save them the way people in the city of Benghazi did. But there are variations of that same theme about what is the U.S. bringing to us, what can the U.S. do, or how is the U.S. making our life difficult. And I find myself in this unique opportunity as a State Department correspondent covering Hillary Clinton, an historic figure. Her legacy, you know, will be debated, but she did bring something very different to the job. And as I was traveling around the world with her across 300,000 miles, I found those two stories very much connected. So the audience that I'm hoping to reach with the secretary is both an audience within Washington, and Karim, I was very glad that you told me that even as someone who's been here for many years, you still found many fresh insights in the book. But I'm also hoping to reach a wider audience, people outside of this room, outside of the Beltway, who don't usually pick up a political book, but who are intrigued and interested to find out more about their country, where their country stands on the global stage, and why they should care about the Arab uprisings, or why they should care about the rise of China, or the rise of countries like Turkey. And that's why I try to write the book like a story. So it's a fun whirlwind tour of the world in the company of an historic figure like Hillary Clinton. We go on, you know, motorcades racing through towns into Saudi king's palaces. We eat curry on the way and lots of taco salads on the secretary's plane. The food, I can assure you, is not that great. But at the same time, you're learning about the stuff of war and peace, about international affairs, and really getting to see what it's like to do the day-to-day job of America's ambassador to the world.
And this is a question I'll pose to both of you, whoever wants to start up. But in the invite, we said that to her critics, Hillary Clinton didn't really have any major achievements during her tenure as Secretary of State. To her supporters, she revolutionized U.S. diplomacy. She brought it to the 21st century with, you know, smart power, using social media, et cetera. So how would both of you grade Hillary's term as secretary? Maybe David, if you want to start, and then Kim.
Well, I think it's a good place to start because it allows me to talk for a moment about what I think is one of the great signal qualities of Kim's book. The fact that you use the device of talking about your own life and how you viewed things from being a teenager, from the perspective of your father, and this sort of sense that America pulls all the strings, mm-hmm. to the conclusions that you reach at the end, makes for a great story. But it does something else. It allows Kim to sketch out an exciting day-to-day tale of how foreign policy works, and it's a journey of coming to understand nuance. It's a journey of coming to understand that America doesn't pull the strings. It doesn't have the power. America is the most powerful country in the world. Right now, sequester on, everything. America's the most powerful country in the history of the world. And if America puts its mind to do something, it has a better chance of getting it done than any other country in the world. But to get from here to putting your mind to doing something, applying the resources, applying them in the right way, and so forth, that's a big leap. That's something that over the course of the 300,000 miles that you traveled with Secretary Clinton, you clearly come to understand. And I think you also clearly come to understand the incredibly potent role that strong personalities play in all of this. Mm. And that one of the great contributions of Secretary Clinton as a secretary was being Hillary Clinton. Yeah. Going, talking to people, listening to people, being prepared in meetings, and that had an effect. And, you know, I've written a lot of things about Hillary Clinton, and every time I write something good, people say, oh, you're in the bag for the Clintons, you were in the Clinton administration, you don't see her flaws. And if I write something negative, they go, you're a right-wing maniac. And, you know, I mean, that... You know, people don't want to see what's in the middle. The great thing about this book is that it understands that she could be extremely effective, that she could be as well-briefed and as energetic as any Secretary of State in modern history, that she could advance smart power in the ways that she systematically did from the outset, that she could systematically work to restore America's role in the world and its reputation in places where it seems a long time ago, but at the end of the Bush administration, that reputation was in dire straits. And I think one of the things that she gets probably the least credit for, but is most important, is that we came out of an 8-year period where the impulse and the first discussion was always about how do we project force? And she came into it and said, first of all, that had some flaws, and secondly, we faced new constraints. And we have to go back to something that was once central and restore it, and that was diplomacy. And she, at the lead in the State Department, went out and said, a country that's not going to go to war, that doesn't have resources, that won't do it alone, needs to make allies, needs to work with its allies, needs to engage more effectively. And she did that. And so I think that's the thing that sets her above and beyond other people. And when you read it in the book, how that happened comes to life. So that's to your credit.
Thank you. Thank you, David. I'm very flattered. And I agree with him, obviously.
How could you disagree after all the...
But it is really about realizing that there isn't always a black or white choice to make, that it isn't always, as you just told me, a binary choice. There is often something in between. And, of course, growing up in Lebanon as a very young child, I can see that. As a journalist covering the Middle East, I understood that better. I knew that, you know, on an intellectual level, of course, the United States didn't have a magic wand, but seeing it up close and getting that front row seat and talking to the people around Clinton and to Clinton herself, because I interviewed her many, many times, including for the book, it really brings it to life. So that's what I try to do in the book. But when it comes to discussing her legacy, yes, her critics will absolutely say there is no peace process in the Middle East to speak of, certainly no peace agreement with Iran, the negotiations, we don't know where they're going to go. Afghanistan, Pakistan, the relationship is still very tense. In Afghanistan, you know, people will say that's still a mess. So you look around and there isn't really a tangible agreement, a tangible piece of paper that you can hold up and say, you know, this is the checklist of exactly what I did. But the achievement is a little bit more intangible. And I think, and I argue in the book, that to look at her legacy from the narrow perspective of which agreements she reached or not misses the bigger scope of American power today. Because America is, you know, the most powerful country, but it can't do anything on its own really anymore. It can do some things, like a raid into Pakistan to get bin Laden. But some other things, because of various constraints, it can't do on its own anymore. So she really worked to devise new ways to collaborate with new countries, not just the traditional allies, but Vietnam to look at the lower Mekong, with Turkey for a counterterrorism conference. She found allies in various places, and she made those changes and that way of doing diplomacy permanent within the State Department. Those changes have now been, you know, sort of codified in the way the building works. And we'll have to see whether John Kerry will pursue that. But to some extent, you know, they are very much on the same page. But one other point, because in the end, you know, she's also a politician. Politics is in her blood. And I think that she's done very well over the last 4 years staying out of the fray of politics, which is why, or above the fray rather, which is why she's doing so well in the polls. But she is a politician, and she did also shy away from a few things that were simply not going to do her reputation any good. And we can go into some of the details, but the Middle East peace process is actually something that she consciously decided she was not going to stake her reputation on that. And then as she did the job over the course of the 4 years, I also think that she was very conscious of the fact that it would be good for her and that she would do well and come out of this looking very good while she served her, to some extent, her own interest as a politician, but also the greater interest of her country as America's ambassador to the world.
Can I just follow up on a couple of those things briefly? First of all, with regard to the Middle East peace process, my view is that foreign policy is a jungle, or rather perhaps a garden. And in the middle of the garden, there grows a tree, and on the tree, there is an apple. And everybody in the garden says, you know, if you eat of this apple, you will have immortality. And, of course, that apple is the Middle East peace process.
The Holy Grail, yeah.
And what happens is you end up getting cast out of the garden because it's almost impossible to achieve the goals that are associated with it. Having said that, you know, part of the reason that Hillary Clinton stayed in certain lanes as opposed to other lanes is foreign policy in this administration is made in the White House. And the White House carved out certain things that it wanted to do. And I think part of what she deserves credit for is, even though it carved out certain things, she went look to Asia, look to strategic rebalancing or the pivot, look to emerging powers, played a central role in a number of other things where she was allowed to have a role. Also, in terms of, you know, success or failure as a Secretary of State, and that it is a bit of a gray area, you know, if you say, well, who's a great Secretary of State? Almost inevitably, you'll pick somebody and realize it's an oversimplification. Was George Marshall a great Secretary of State? Well, of course, because he gave us the Marshall Plan, except he didn't actually give us the Marshall Plan. It was something that Truman and a couple of other people cooked up with and decided that if Marshall gave the speech, they'd get credit for it. So that isn't really good. Was Henry Kissinger a great Secretary of State? This half of the room says yes. This half of the room says he was a war criminal.
There are very strong opinions about that in the Middle East.
Of course. And if, you know, is James Baker a great Secretary of State? Well, he was a great negotiator. He was full of energy. He had a great relationship with the president and the National Security Advisor. He, you know, pissed off everybody in Israel in one fell swoop. And, you know, he did a number of, you know, so the reality is there aren't clear cut people, you know, who are, you know, just an A plus or an F. And part of the reason for that is the job of Secretary of State is mostly blocking and tackling. It is mostly stuff that happens every day. It's like the Chinese lacquer box. It gets made with 1,000 layers. Every layer adds luster. Every layer, you know, makes it what it is. And one can't make these kind of binary choices. And I think, you know, each anecdote, each incident in the book shows that. That you can do something and it can be an unsuccessful trip, but in the long run, it can pay off.
Hmm. Let me just follow up very quickly, because there was one thing that struck me as I was reporting and interviewing people for the book. I spoke to people outside of Washington. You know, I spoke to people in Pakistan, Libya, Turkey, France, the UK. And I was really struck by how everybody was unanimous that Hillary Clinton was one of America's greatest secretaries of state. And sometimes I wondered whether their view was partially impacted or partially formed because, you know, she walks into the room and she's usually the biggest person in the room, unless perhaps, you know, it's the king of Saudi Arabia or, you know, usually she's the biggest person in the room. And there is this celebrity factor that you were talking about that achieves a lot. And so she is seen abroad, certainly, as the greatest secretary, as one of America's greatest secretary of state, because she is always willing to listen and always willing to figure out a way of doing things together. And she told me, for example, you know, Turkey's foreign minister, Ahmet Davutoğlu, don't always agree with him, but I understand where he's coming from. So let's see how we can work together.
David, you alluded to this a little bit about how foreign policy and the Obama administration is often perceived as being made at the White House, at the NSC. You wrote a book about the history of the NSC. Is that, first of all, is that an accurate assessment that foreign policy and this Obama administration is not made at the State Department, it's made at the White House? And second, if true, is that an historic aberration, or has that generally been the norm that presidents keep foreign policy on tight hold and secretaries of state go out and execute the president's foreign policy?
Well, I'm actually writing the sequel to that book now that dealt with deals the second half of the Bush administration and the Obama administration. So we can just finish that conversation in a year when I figure out the answer. But I think, first of all power in the executive branch falls from the president. You have exactly as much power and latitude as the president gives you. So at the end of the day, if the president wants to engage in foreign policy or hold it close, he will. Over the course of the past 30 or 40 years, for a variety of reasons, the sort of tightening of the news cycle, the fact that information gets circulated very quickly and therefore always has a political consequence, and the White House is the political nerve center of the administration, and also the ability, you know, the State Department used to play this big role of kind of messenger. Mm-hmm. You know, you had to speak to the ambassador to carry the message. Well, that, you know, in the age of modern technology, doesn't make any sense at all. And so for a variety of reasons, the NSC and the president at the center have grown more and more central to foreign policy. But this White House has taken it to a new extreme. Mm-hmm. There is a small group that plays a much more hands-on role on a variety of critical issues, such a hands-on role that there are people within the White House that feel like they're on the outside of the small group which is political and close to the president. And if you read accounts of this or you talk to people, you get this sense that that the president's not actually using his cabinet as he might. That we in foreign policy this month, the issue that comes out today, there's an excerpt from Vali Nasser's book which talks about this. I had a piece in the New York Times a couple weeks ago saying that I thought the president was not a very successful manager. Right. And what I was talking about was close hold, not empowering the staff. And it made some people in the White House a little bit uncomfortable. But I'll tell you a little secret if you promise not to tell anybody. And that is every single source for that article was a senior administration official. Okay? In other words, this is widely known within the administration. It's widely felt. People can love Obama, love the agenda, love the team around Obama, and still feel alienated by the process, and I think that's what's happened.
Was that felt at the State Department, that resentment that it was the White House that was controlling foreign policy and Hillary wasn't given enough latitude?
Yes and no. And I'll tell you why the two answers. I think that how the State Department does as a building is very dependent on the personality of the Secretary of State. Secretary Rice had a very close relationship with President Bush. She didn't rely very much on the building. She had been National Security Advisor before. She just went straight to the president. They were on the same team from the very beginning. Hillary Clinton was obviously a rival to President Obama. She and the president made peace when they decided to work together. Their teams didn't really, to put it mildly. They continued to distrust each other. But she was Hillary Clinton, and she could go above anyone else, mostly, almost anyone at the White House, to speak directly to the president. She had access to him on a weekly basis. And she was a great advocate for the building. And that's another thing that struck me about her, is that she turned out to be quite a good manager of this, you know, mastodon that is the State Department in Foggy Bottom. And I think that she had a lot of influence on many decisions, perhaps not on Afghanistan, as Vali Nasser points out. She was on the losing end of that battle. But she kept an eye on the bigger picture. And the bigger picture is, in this day and age, pushing America's agenda on the world stage, making sure that America maintains the edge or an edge, is a full-time job. And it requires getting on a plane and going to talk to people and putting in the miles and talking to them again and meeting with them face-to-face and picking up the phone repeatedly. But another point I want to make, which is part of why I wrote the book, is that in the end, I think the discussion about who really pulls the strings or makes the final call in the foreign policy making process in Washington is fascinating for people like us, for journalists, for people in the administration, for academics, for think tanks. But you have to remember that at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter who made the decision if you're living on the receiving end of it. So for people in Beirut, for people in Afghanistan, they have to live with the result of the decision. And I think that is often overlooked at this end of it. Mm. Of course, it matters who weighs in and who doesn't. But I think we tend to forget that this has an impact on real people for whom the detail of, you know, who is up and who's down in Washington doesn't really matter.
You know, and there's an added dimension to this, which is, and which I think the book makes the point extremely well, and it goes back to your father's quote at the beginning. People in Washington
don't... I should really thank my father for all of this.
Yes, you should. And would you like to take a moment to think? Yeah. As a father of daughters, daughters should thank their fathers. But,
absolutely. I'll tell you a little story at the end about how much I have to thank my father.
Okay, but well, you know, there's a perception that you know the United States pulls the strings, makes the policy, and that the senior people make the policy, and the president makes policy more than the Secretary of State. But the people that make most U.S. foreign policy don't live in the U.S. It's people outside in the world who create events that the United States reacts to. And then the next most influential group of people are everybody who came before them, because U.S. foreign policy is huge continuity in it. Mm. And then after that, it's the people who've been balancing the budget or working the economy, because ultimately our strength comes from how healthy our economy is and whether we've got the money to spend on these kind of things, and so on and so forth. So it takes you a while before you get down to the people who are currently sitting in the office making the decision. And so it distorts the whole, you know, the whole discussion.
That's right.
I mean, I read this great quote in The Economist recently, which said, you know, the problem with foreign policy is that it all relies on foreigners, and they don't always do what you want. And I think that that is something that people in Washington sometimes forget, and that even people who are those foreigners forget, because it's, you know, at the same time, they complain about why the U.S. isn't delivering for them, but they're not willing to do anything to help the U.S. deliver on something else. The other point that I wanted to make was that it was interesting to see how Hillary Clinton picked her battles within the administration, and I detail a little bit in the book how she weighed in, because in the end, if you know the president wants something to happen on the world stage, he may be the decider, but he is not out there traveling the world, rallying people to his sort of cause, quote unquote. So it was up to Hillary Clinton to go to the French and the British when Libya was unfolding and say, okay, what is it exactly that you can bring to the table? What are your plans? Where are you exactly on what kind of resolution we're going to put forward at the UN? Then she went to the Libyans to assess, you know, were these really people that we could do business with or not? What were they going to bring? And then she got the Arabs on board. Do you want us to do this? You're calling for a no-fly zone? Fine, but are you going to put your money where your mouth is? Are you going to get involved militarily? And that's where I think her influence is, beyond necessarily deciding always what the course of action was going to be. It was going to be about delivering to the president what it was that he needed to follow a certain course of action and bring him sometimes to that decision, because the president had not decided yet that he would go for a UN resolution calling for all necessary measures to protect civilians in Libya. Mm. We're talking about March 2011 here. She went through her famous checklist and said, okay, if this is what we want to do, this is what we need, and this is what I need to deliver to the president. And she has this interesting way of making her case and then letting the other almost come to the conclusion that she knows he's going to take once she's presented all the details to him.
Also, she has an operational capability that the White House doesn't have. And almost inevitably, if the White House can want to control everything, but the biggest problem in the White House is bandwidth. And so they just literally can't get involved in every issue, and that left a lot out there for her to take advantage of. And she acquired her power and her reputation by working in the areas that were left to her. Mm-hmm. And it was only after succeeding in those areas that she gained more and more influence internally.
There's a great passage, Kim, which kind of touches upon what you just described, the challenge of reconciling the interests and the asks of various countries. And you say, governments everywhere that instinctively and narrowly pursued their national interests somehow expected the U.S. to suspend the pursuit of its own interests to please them. The Arabs wanted the United States to ditch the Israelis. The Israelis wanted the United States to bomb Iran. The Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad wanted Obama to wait with him for the Shiite Messiah. Pakistan wanted to be given Afghanistan on a golden platter. India wanted the United States to say it could have Kashmir. Japan wanted Washington to make Beijing go away, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And these are the various asks you get. So there's that, but then there's the maxim from Henry Kissinger, said that there's no such thing as a foreign policy. It's essentially domestic policy. And this is Valley's critique of the Obama White House. And this is the piece which you guys ran today, David, in which Valley describes the Obama White House as a quote unquote inexperienced cabal in which foreign policy has become completely subservient to tactical domestic political considerations. So you did touch upon that a little bit. So is that, seen from the perspective of the State Department, Is that also a valid critique? One, and then two, there's also somewhat that critique of Hillary Clinton as well, that she's surrounded by this team of loyalists who are not foreign policy experts, they're advisors who have been with her a long time. And did you see kind of her image or domestic politics ever interfering in the interests of foreign policy?
I think domestic politics interfered a little bit at the beginning. On her first trip to Asia, she was still very conscious of her constituents in New York. But my observation was that over the course of her 4 years, her immediate political considerations were put to the side to some extent, but she always, I think, as a politician, keeps an eye on the long term. And the long term is, you know, the potential of 2016. But whatever she could do to serve her country and to serve her president was going to be good for her. So that is the sort of domestic politics aspect of her tenure. And as I said, you know, she is a politician, but she used that also to her advantage in her conversations with world leaders. And she could tell them, listen, I've been there. I've suffered the slings and arrows. I've been up and down in the polls. I know how it's difficult to deliver for your constituents. You have your domestic political agenda. But here's why I think this would be good for you. Now, when it comes to the United States and her role in the U.S. and in the administration, I think that she was very conscious of the fact that she needed to carve her own role and space away from the president. They are two big personalities, big figures, and they stayed away from each other's limelight. You know, you didn't see her give a speech at a university in Virginia the way Kerry did on his first big speech on foreign policy, simply because it would have been perceived as challenging the president or stepping on his turf, because it's a domestic audience. But in the book, I also talk about how domestic considerations have always been there, whether it's in this White House or in previous White House. And I go back all the way to Truman, who has to make a decision about whether to back the creation of a state of Israel or not. And there's a standoff between the White House and the State Department. The State Department saying, I don't think it's a good idea. You know, the Arab world is going to be up in arms. There's a lot to lose. And he ends up making that decision to back the creation of the State of Israel because he has, you know, Jewish constituents. He's facing re-election. And, you know, his political advisors inside the White House tell the State Department, you don't get it. The president has to face a re-election. And that's all that we care for or that we care about at the moment. But just on your last point about the people that Hillary Clinton surrounded herself with, yes, it's true. She came to the State Department with a small knit group of close advisors like Philip Reines, like Huma Abedin, like Lisa Muscatine. She also had colleagues and friends who had been with her at the White House, Milan Verwer, Anne Stock. But she also had others who were not necessarily in her close circle that she appointed to positions at the State Department. And the White House gave her that latitude, which is unusual because she was Hillary Clinton. And then she had people like Jake Sullivan, who is not necessarily a foreign policy practitioner, is a lawyer, has been involved in foreign policy issues. And there are, you know, advantages and disadvantages. But going back to the question about where she fits in the administration, Jake Sullivan and Ben Rhodes talk a lot, are very close. So that was kind of a connection which helped to bypass some of the structural sort of, you know, obstacles in the discussion between the State Department and the White House.
Mm-hmm. I mean, David, to what extent is our friend Valinas's critique applicable only to the Obama administration, and to what extent is it a valid critique of every U.S. administration, that, you know, foreign policy is often driven by domestic political considerations?
Well, two separate issues. One is probably the most overused term in my book on the NSC, and there are plenty of overused cliches in that book, was where you sit is where you stand. Mm. And this is, you know, this is sort of a Washington truism that's developed because, you know, you have people sometimes sit in the White House and make the case for White House strength and then get appointed to a cabinet agency and end up making the case for cabinet agency strength. And Vali's critique, while fair because there was a small group, has coloring language, cabal, and so forth, which is due to the frustration that they didn't have the ability to get the traction and make what they wanted to make have happen. Richard Holbrooke was a friend of mine. I talked to him about it. There was a lot of frustration there. And indeed, you know, this was a fraught policy. You had a 10-month Afghanistan policy process, which had the rather remarkable, outcome of doubling down in Afghanistan and announcing our withdrawal in the same speech. Mm. People point their fingers one way or another at what was wrong with it. But this was a fraught period, and I don't think people really understood where they wanted to go. So part of it was confusion. Part of it was territorialism. Part of it was natural institutional tendencies. I mean, there has never been an administration where there wasn't conflict between one branch of the government or the other. Donald Rumsfeld and Colin Powell, or Caspar Weinberger and George Shultz, these rivalries exist. Now, as far as domestic politics go, that colors it in a couple ways. One, the people closest to the president were domestic political advisors, and so they were always looking at it through a particular lens. But that's always the case. And you go back to Truman, you can go back to Washington. Washington said the only reason to actually engage with international, with other players in the world, was to advance our commercial interests at home. And that's a recurrent theme throughout U.S. history. Foreign policy is to advance national interests. You want to call it domestic politics? You want to call it national interests? It's the same thing. And so it's very hard to disconnect them, and it's why political leaders, politicians, can be quite successful as secretaries of state.
Yeah.
Whether it was Hillary Clinton or James Baker, or people who, Henry Kissinger is political to every cell, every sliver of his DNA.
Mm. And don't forget that every country's foreign policy is to some extent dictated by their own domestic agenda. And that's why I go into, the personalities of these people that Hillary Clinton is trying to engage as she goes about her job as Secretary of State, whether it's the Pakistanis or Benjamin Netanyahu or President Abbas or the Turks. They have their own domestic political considerations that they're trying to deal with, as they do foreign policy.
Mm. I want to now look forward to kind of focus less on Hillary's tenure and look forward in the coming years of U.S. foreign policy, particularly at the State Department. John Kerry has just been in office.
During the next 4 years or during the Clinton administration?
During the next 4 years, and I'm sure there will be...
Just depending on how far forward you want it to go.
I think the audience probably is going to ask about the Clinton administration in 2016, But John Kerry has been in office he's been Secretary of State just a few weeks now, but he was chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee a long time, and I think all of us are pretty familiar with his views. You've already written about Kerry, but how do you see his instincts as different than Hillary Clinton's? Richard Haass had a great line. He said that John Kerry has some pretty large Manolo Blahnik heels to
except that he got his fashion, references.
Prada's, right?
Well, he said Manolo Blahnik's, but she's more a fan of Prada shoes. But that's okay.
I defer to you on that one. But how do you see his instincts different on these key issues, whether it's Iran, Syria, Russia, etc.?
Well, first, personality makes a big difference, right?
Yeah.
She is a polymath, studies everything, immerses herself in things, has quite a global view, I think is fundamentally very strategic in the way that she looks at things, is an excellent manager. Who knew? But it turned out she was an excellent manager. And she's a leader. In a particular kind of way. Now, clearly, Kerry was the Democratic presidential nominee, and he's been a leader in the Senate for a long time. But at his root core, he's a senator.
Mm.
And, you know, that involves consensus and collaboration and being able to stand behind a group of people in a certain kind of a way. And Joe Biden and Barack Obama are much more to their root core senators and, you know, infused with that culture than she was, who I think, you know, because she started out in public life as a first lady in the executive branch and grew from there, it colors what she's doing. I think she's a little bit more daring. I think she has her own political constituency in a way that he didn't. I think there's certain issues that are going to be front and center issues for her that aren't for him, and vice versa. He was the leading champion of climate. He will continue to be. In the first days he was in the State Department, he was talking to people about oceans and other things as a priority. She was concerned with women's issues and empowering disadvantaged populations, with IT as an issue, with 21st century statecraft. You know, and so those are other kinds of differences. And you know, we're only part of the way through the story. John Kerry will never be president of the United States. There's still a pretty good chance Hillary Clinton will be president of the United States. And the fact that we think that that is a dichotomy between the two of them, whether it happens or not, I think tells you the most about the differences between the two of them at their core.
Yeah, I agree with David. It is going to be very much about a difference in style, not so much in tone, because I think they see the world more or less in the same way. Clinton is perhaps more forceful and assertive in her desire to see America lead, perhaps even more so than the president. And certainly the way that she frames the conversation about American leadership is more forceful and assertive than John Kerry would do. He is going to focus on things like climate change. He's not going to ignore women's rights, but he's not going to devote as much attention to it, although some of the focus on women's rights and women's issues and children's issues at the State Department has now become part of the functioning of the State Department. You know, you have to budget for women's programs at the State Department now. It's just how it is, as part of how Clinton, redefined the way some of the ways that the building does business. He'll probably be a little bit less interested in Asia or less focused on it, and I think his focus is going to be very much on the Middle East, because of that apple in the garden that you were talking about, which I call the holy grail of every American administration. You know, they want that peace process. And I think that it's very possible that we will see John Kerry pursue that. I don't know how much latitude he will get from the White House. I don't know how interested President Obama is actually going to be in his second term. The situation on the ground certainly isn't any better than it was 4 years ago when they tried it. So it may be a failed attempt again. But he is interested more in the sort of the negotiating, the mediating, and it seems to me a little bit less in the big picture. And then, of course, you know, you have Syria. And there is a little bit of damage to be undone about his initial comments about President Assad and his belief that President Assad would deliver on reform. But he's now very busy gathering a coalition of people who are willing to do something in some way towards Syria that doesn't involve the United States intervening militarily. So we've seen this first step of the announcement that the U.S. would provide non-lethal aid to the rebels in Syria. But, of course, that is a result of several weeks and months of conversations already within the administration that started well before he came to power.
And also of her advocating
absolutely
actively for much more than that.
Yeah.
And this is a compromise down. But, you know, just listening to you talk and thinking about it a little bit, there may be one other thing here. Yes, Hillary Clinton went to Wellesley, and yes, she went to Yale Law School, and yes, you know, she seems very mainstream right now. But for most of her career, she's been an outsider. She went to Arkansas. She, you know, when they came to town, they were these bubbas. They were from out of town. They, you know, they weren't part of the mainstream. And the fact that she's a woman matters. It more than it might for some other women, because she's been actively involved at the barricades in the women's movement from the day she sort of entered college onward. And so she's much more of an insurgent than John Kerry is. And John Kerry is more of an establishment guy, and he's, you know, I mean, yes, he was against the war, and, you know, he took a view, but, you know, where he was from, taking the view that he took, was not a radical, radical view, right? And so I think that this is part of it. And as a result, she was, you know, her foreign policy agenda, where was her first trip? Japan, that was the first time that ever happened. China, Asia, she embraced emerging markets, partially because she was elbowed out of some of the good places, partially because she did. She sort of really, really sat down and thought, what's a 21st century agenda for the United States? John Kerry's first trip was to Europe and to the Middle East. Very traditional.
Yeah, very traditional, absolutely. And you can tell also from the schedule of his trip that it's a much more traditional approach to diplomacy, perhaps because it's his first trip and he's still, you know, trying to figure out exactly how he wants to do the job, which she also had to do, you know, when she became Secretary of State. But I wasn't able to go on this first trip because this book, which is a great thing. So I can't tell you what he's like on the road yet. That's perhaps another book in 4 years.
It's a very small team of advisors.
A very small team of advisors and a very traditional schedule. It's meetings with leaders and not so much public diplomacy. But I do think that although he is very traditional, I wonder whether we might see him be more daring and willing to put more on the line to get something like the Middle East peace process, because, you know, he's not going to run again, not for president. You know, it's that's kind of his last big job, perhaps. And so he's perhaps willing to risk more than Hillary Clinton was, because she knew that she perhaps had a longer political career in front of her.
I have a couple more questions before I hand it over to all of you, so if you can get your questions ready. David, you wrote a great book called Superclass, which is kind of chronicling the global power/moneyed elite. And there was a quote I read from a commencement speaker at Berkeley, of all places, last year, who told this audience, graduating Berkeley class of 2012, that if you want to change the world, become bankers. Because in today's world, money is what changes the world. Now, my question, I guess, for both of you is, how powerful is this institution of Secretary of State? One of the interesting things from your book, Kim, is describing the Secretary of State's plane, that is kind of this creaky old plane from the 1980s.
I was very disappointed.
Exactly. You expect something and...
Oh, boy. When we were flying around the Clinton administration, it was a Boeing 707 that Dwight Eisenhower used to fly on.
So I shouldn't complain.
But you know, if your goal is to establish, you know, to acquire power these days in the world, would you advise someone to go and do a PhD at SAIS or to get an MBA? Is power kind of is money the new power?
Well, one of our colleagues here, Moises Naim, has a book out saying the end of power. So, you know, you could give up. Of course, I think the reality is power exists in manifold forms and remains extremely concentrated in the hands of a few. And as I said at the beginning, there is one nation on earth that has the ability to wage a war from space, from the sky, from the sea, and on land, any place, any time, and in multiple places, one country. And the Secretary of State represents the voice of that country internationally, is the top-ranking cabinet officer in that government. And whatever you may say about the, you know, here we're pulling out our hair, oh my God, it's a sequester. But then, you know, you go and you read the fine print, you realize that cutting our defense budget represents not actually cutting our defense budget, it represents cutting the rate of growth in our defense budget, which is not exactly the same thing. So, you know, we have enormous power, and the United States government has enormous power, and there is still not a major issue on earth where people don't say, what's the U.S. going to do, how do we get them involved, or if they don't get involved, that becomes a decisive factor in the outcome. You can have a lot of power as a banker. You could have a lot of power as a producer of natural gas. You can have a lot of power if you create Facebook. You can have a lot of power using the internet to create, you know, an NGO movement. There are a lot of ways that you can have it. The tools of technology today allow people to amass it and spread it more rapidly. They allow it to ebb and flow more rapidly, but they certainly haven't ended power. And so I think there are a lot of avenues that those students could have pursued. Being a banker was certainly not the only one.
Mm. Or you can be the Secretary of State and you can go and talk to bankers, which is what Hillary Clinton did. And she was very much a believer in, you know, economic statecraft. And she gave a lot of speeches about that because she realized that, yes, money is power. And in this day and age where the United States doesn't have, you know, endless cash flow, it needs to figure out different ways of doing things and harnessing the power of money. But also, as you know, David was saying, and as Moises has written in his book, power is very diffuse these days. There's many ways of wielding power. It is the politician, it is the bankers, it is money, and you know there are shady underworlds of power as well. And it's important to recognize that, because when you're living in a country like Lebanon or Pakistan or China or wherever, it's important to understand, I think, that power isn't some absolute thing that one person possesses, and if you are not with them or there, then you don't have any power at all. And that's a little bit what I was also trying to achieve by writing The Secretary, to show that there are all these different avenues where you can have influence, and to show how even though the U.S. is still the most powerful country, it also struggles to advance its interests, advance its agenda, get other people on board, because it's just become too easy to say, you know, there's nothing we can do about this. The U.S. is against us. Or if, you know, the peace process isn't going anywhere, it's because America has willed it. If there is no action in Syria, it's because the U.S. has decided that it doesn't want to help the Syrians. It's not those binary choices. And power is very diffuse, but there are ways of harnessing it.
Well, you know, I would say, just as a slight nuance on that, there are a lot of channels, there are a lot of ways to power. So in that sense, it's diffuse. But ultimately, the winning hand is the one with the most power. And therefore, one aggregates among those diffuse hands. Mm. And so if you look at big businesses, they're getting bigger. If you know, now some small ones become big rapidly, but they are getting bigger. There are only 17 countries on the planet that have the ability to project force outside their border for more than 3 or 4 days. Mm. So that means, you know, that some of those smaller countries have got to gang together and other kinds of things. And I think that it's not that power is over, or you know, power has actually taken on a dramatically new form. It's that as the world ebbs and flows, we find new ways to aggregate it, new mechanisms to express it. And that is, so it's that we're in a new era of power. And I think that's what 21st century statecraft was about understanding.
Yeah.
How do you harness the internet? Mm-hmm. How do you harness financial power, economic power, the power of emerging states, the power of existing states, old institutions, new institutions? Mm-hmm.
So the last question I have for both of you before handing it over to all of you is, you know, what known factors or potential black swans do you think could dramatically affect global politics, U.S. foreign policy, geopolitics? You've written, David, a bit about the shale oil windfall in the United States, which will revolutionize the energy industry and potentially the importance of the Middle East to U.S. foreign policy. But you know, what are the other things that you see that in the coming years and decades could dramatically change how U.S. foreign policy is wielded?
Well, look, first of all, every time I get in a conversation with about somebody with about black swans, they'll say, well, you can't predict them because if you could predict them, they wouldn't be black swans.
That's right. Yeah.
That's just not true. Every black swan that has happened in the course of the past 20, 30 years that you would point to, 9/11, fall of the Soviet Union, all those things were predicted. It was just whether we expected them or not, or we were prepared for them or not. There are a lot of big things that are happening in the world that are changing. 1.8 billion people will enter the world's middle class between now and 2030. That's going to change the balance of power in the world. There are going to be a couple of hundred cities of over a million people, almost all of them built in Asia. That's going to change the balance of power in the world. Energy resources are going to come from different places. That, you know, whether it's shale or whether it's the pre-salt offshore of Brazil or it's new offshore drilling, and we're going to use energy in different ways due to efficiency and new technologies. We just discovered couple years ago that when rare earth metals were, you know, critical to alternative energy and the Chinese withheld them, that was a source of power. Supply chains change as a result of it, so new choke points exist in the world. That's going to change the nature of power. And of course, there are the old upsets. Right now, from Tunisia to the Hindu Kush, every single place in the Middle East is less stable than it was, you know, on average over the course of the past couple of decades. And all those places could connect, because a lot of the things that were keeping a lid on that part of the world are no longer keeping a lid on it. The United States is leaning back. Other powers are leaning back. We're broke. The Europeans are broke. All of a sudden, the Chinese are involved. The Russians are involved. It's much more complicated. And we're building drone bases in Africa. The largest Al-Qaeda-controlled space on Earth is in Mali. Extremism is spreading in different places. So, you know, I think we're entering a period in which the risks are going to remain diverse and serious, but the big story is going to be growth and prosperity. Mm. And, you know, I think that's one of the things that we have to think about. You know, we're always, you know, what's a big game changer? Oh, somebody's going to get the bomb. Cyber warfare is going to be. And those are real things. I think that's important. But the big story is 2 billion people who weren't in the middle class, entering the middle class, and having the aspirations and expectations that are associated with it.
Yeah.
And I also think bringing it back to some of what I discuss in the book about the role of the United States and American power, you know, you can talk about the end of power, declining America, the fusion of power. But I think that it's always interesting to ask the question, you know, fine, we've seen the downside in the view of some of too much American power. What happens if the U.S. has too little power as well? So that, I think, is an interesting question that people often don't, particularly outside of the U.S., don't spend a lot of time following through. They would, you know, they would like to see America retreat. They would like to see less American influence. They would like to see America humiliated, but they don't necessarily follow through the thinking in terms of what that would actually mean if suddenly, you know, you have global gridlock because no one has the power to do anything.
Yeah.
And when it comes to specific issues, obviously I think that, as David mentions, there is a lot of instability in the Arab world, whether it's still in Tunisia or Egypt or Syria. Certainly that has a greater strategic impact across the Middle East, whatever happens in Syria. And I think that when it comes to black swans, it isn't that you can't predict them, it's that you can't predict when they're going to happen. And I remember at the beginning of 2011, I sat down with some of Clinton's advisors, and they were just casually asking, you know, you've covered this beat before. You know, what is it like the last year of a Secretary of State? You know, what drives the agenda, or how do you define, you know, the last 2 years of a Secretary of State? And not really thinking about it, I said, well, you know what, unexpected events usually. And 2 years and 2 weeks later, the Arab Spring started. So I think that there will always be those events that you kind of know are bubbling under the surface. You just don't know exactly when they will drive the agenda, because there were a lot of predictors about the Arab Spring. No one could have predicted exactly when it was going to erupt and what the extent was going to be and how far and fast it was going to spread. But I think a lot of people in the audience were taken aback when Clinton spoke to an audience in Doha, in Qatar, in January 2011, and said, you know, this region is sinking in the sand. Mm. And I think that even she didn't realize how prescient she was being.
That's right. That's right. I'd like to hand it over to all of you. If you can be concise and wait for the microphone, please, here in the front row, the second front row. And please introduce yourself.
Thank you. Thank you, Kim. Thank you, David, for this extremely informative and your insights, your analysis. Quick comment and a question. The comment is about Hillary Clinton's legacy, and both of you said a lot about that, but I would like to add maybe one thing and see if you agree with it. As you said, Kim, it's about the role of the United States and the power of America. And I think her legacy is about redefining all of that and redefining in a very serious way by saying it's three Ds, not one, not two. And the three Ds are defense, diplomacy, and development. Mm-hmm. And her focus on development is unprecedented. I mean, she's amazing what she did in development. I come from that field. That's my career. And she meant it, she lived it, she did it. She would go to Congo and not meet just with presidents and prime ministers and secretaries of state there or foreign ministers. She'd go to the villages and meet with women.
And she made African leaders come with her.
And she made African leaders come with her.
To the villages.
And she would meet victims of gender-based violence. Mm-hmm. The women's issues that you mentioned, both of you, were priority on her agenda. No other Secretary of State did that. It isn't just because of it's a women's issue. It's a global issue. It's a global issue that connects the U.S. in a very humane way to other countries, that makes the populations in other countries respect more the U.S., can appreciate more the U.S., and recognize that leaders in the U.S. of the weight of Hillary Clinton, that global weight, connect with the population, the underprivileged. My question is it possible that a Secretary of State will continue on that line, the three Ds? And she tried to equalize them. Total challenge. I recognize that. Defense, diplomacy, and development, equalize those three. Total challenge. But she was daring. Is it possible that they continue?
So why don't actually, that's a great question. I'll bunch together a couple more so you can take, please, here in the middle.
Rosemary Reed, DC Historical Society. You've talked all the whole evening about your book, the secretary, but you haven't mentioned the husband. And I was wondering, when are you going to mention her husband and his influence? Okay.
Why don't you,
I think you make a great point about women's rights, and I think that, to her credit, Clinton was able to connect with people at various levels, whether she was talking to a leader, whether she was talking to an NGO worker, whether she was talking to students, and she really mainstreamed the conversation about women's rights in a way that hadn't been done before. And initially, there was a lot of eye-rolling. She would bring up the issue of women's rights, and you know, people at the State Department, in the administration, or even on her foreign trips would roll their eyes. But she put it to them in terms that were accessible. She said, look, you know, you can't leave half your population behind if you intend to move forward economically. So just think about it in economic terms. You have to include these people. They are women. They can benefit your economy. And that's how she got world leaders in countries that haven't necessarily thought about it like that to acknowledge that they needed to include women and development. But I just wanted to point out that obviously, yes, it does make the U.S. A more amicable power, but there will always be criticism about U.S. double standards, always, because I can assure you that people in Bahrain see things very differently, or part of the population in Bahrain that is rising against its leaders and believes that they are being abandoned by the U.S., that the U.S. is siding with the authorities. They don't see the U.S. as an amicable power that is doing the best that it can for their rights. So, yes, overall, I think that Hillary Clinton did present a more friendly face of a superpower. But, you know, the fate of a superpower, I think, is always to be loved and resented, probably in equal measures. I don't know if you'd like to add anything, David, before I take on the husband question.
I'll leave that one to you. But the first of all, I think, to be fair, we must acknowledge the role that other administrations play with regard to development. And if the Bush administration, which did a lot in Africa, indeed had probably better relations in Latin America and in India in some respects than did this administration. And preceding administrations have also done development. I'd like to just make one footnote to this. People who think that women's rights is a peripheral issue take a very distorted view of the world. If you characterize it that the majority population of the planet Earth is the most underrepresented politically, is the most constrained in terms of economic opportunity, is the most critical to achieving economic stability and political stability and growth in countries, to public health, to education, to a whole host of other things, that's not a soft issue. That's not a secondary issue. And I can assure you, in Afghanistan, where where we leave, it's not going to be an issue that presents itself in soft or secondary terms. There are going to be some very ugly outcomes. Hillary Clinton has been one of the most effective advocates for women's rights since she was first lady, when she made the trip to China and beyond. And this is core foreign policy. This is core national security. And she took a lot of courage to put it in the center. And I think it takes a lot of willful blindness to try to move it out after she's done so.
Yeah, and she's made some of those changes, as I said, permanent in the building. And so she will no doubt advise Secretary Kerry, friendly advice. She's not going to try to step on his toes. But I think she spent quite some time talking to him about how she feels that, this job should be carried forward and what aspects of the job he should maintain. And he has said that he will appoint a new or continue to have the position of ambassador at large for women's issues. But it's very personality driven. Will it be the same if it's not Milan Rivera? It depends on who he appoints. Will they be as driven? Will he be as focused? That all depends on some of the personalities and the people that get appointed, who get appointed at the State Department. I haven't mentioned the husband because I was really just focused on covering her as Secretary of State. It isn't a pure biography, so I didn't delve into that aspect of her life. I can tell you from speaking to some of her friends that he obviously gave her advice along the way. I don't know, David may know much more about this, but he did, she did ask for his counsel often or occasionally. They stayed in touch a lot while she was on the road. They go on holidays together. But I think that one thing that is interesting to point out is that as she went on in those 4 years as Secretary of State, something interesting happened, which is that she had always been her own person in her own right, but she emerged fully from the shadows of her of her husband. She had often been Clinton number two, and now she's just Hillary one. And I think there's this great moment in the Golden Globes award ceremony where the host, after Bill Clinton speaks on stage, says, "Oh my God, it's so exciting! That was Hillary Clinton's husband," and that's kind of where we are now. So it'll be interesting to see if she does decide to run, how that combination will work.
That's right. Let me take a last round of questions here in the front. Amal, please.
Thank you, and congratulations. I really am so proud of
you. Is the microphone working? Yeah, okay.
I just want to ask about Syria. You just said at the beginning that how she advised the president, how she brought everything to him to make him able to make the decision. What kind of input you think she had on the Syria issue, and how did she feel about it really for the last 2 years? Because I remember at the first part of the revolution, there was some criticism of her positions, especially some statements that she made and stuff like that. So could you please tell us how did she feel about this? Where did she stand on the Syria issue? And was the position of helping the opposition her defining moment, or there were other things the last 2 years that define her policy on Syria, the Syria issue? Thank you.
You know, we'll get another question.
Way back. Next.
Thanks, Mr. Sajapour. Thank you, Mr. Rothkopf. My name is Steve. I work in the news business and study IR. I'm a peer and admirer of Kim's. So I would sign on also to the question about Syria. I've one among four questions. So you gave a pretty good interview of the Secretary last February 26th, Kim. Bashar al-Assad remains. Hillary Clinton is gone. So could you sort of get into the interest that the Secretary of State and the fourth Secretary of State brought to trying to depose, I guess, Mr. Assad. Another question is, I guess, to Mr. Rothkopf. Kim mentioned Lisa, she mentioned Phil. Cheryl Mills, another pretty heavy figure on Secretary Clinton's staff. Could she be considered sort of a play on your title, Hillary Inc., in that sense? And the third question, not four, you have three pages in the book. I started it last night, and very brief mentions of Ambassador Stevens. There's a really, really small mention on the last page. I guess it's 335. So could you look also at the influence of his death and maybe that return ceremony, she and the president, on her view of, I guess, the object consequences of foreign policy?
Thank you. And last question here in the middle row, please.
Thank you, Sonny Schott with Globovision Venezuela. Actually, I was trying to find out if you have any conclusion about what happened in the Benghazi consulate, if this, in a way, threatened the legacy of Hillary Clinton. And the second one, very short, it is sometimes when the U.S. refers to its foreign policy, they always ask or they always talk about our national interest. Don't you think it is a little bit confused for the rest of the world? What is the national interest of the U.S. if it's in the same page of the rest of the world? Thank you.
Okay. Amal, let me start with your question about Syria. I think that as we've been discussing in this conversation, there isn't ever, a binary choice. Are we going to help or are we not going to help? There are many factors that play into the conversation. And I think that from the very beginning, there was a recognition that the administration had to come out in support of the protesters. But they were certainly hoping, I think, that President Assad would take his clue from what had happened in other countries and take on board the idea that he had to reform if he didn't want to meet the fate of other regional leaders who had been deposed from power. I'd go into some details about the Syria conference that we went to in Tunisia in February of 2011, when she made some of those statements that were seen by the opposition as a letdown. And I go into this discussion about perceptions of what American statements actually mean and what they represent for the people that they are, in a way, addressed to. And I thought that she was very forthcoming and very honest when she said, look, I can sit here and say, yes, we're going to go in and we're going to go, get President Assad, but we don't have what it takes at the moment to do that. So what's the point of making such a statement? And you can see this as almost too honest, because it's dispiriting to the opposition on the ground, who suddenly think, oh, well, I guess we're on our own. But at the same time, if you're always waiting for the cavalry to come, when actually everybody knows the cavalry isn't coming, then you're not serving your own interests very, very well. I think that she was very frustrated, not just with the debate inside the administration, but what she had in terms of elements that she could work with on the ground. Because unlike the discussion about Libya, she couldn't come to the president and say, we've got a well-functioning, eloquent opposition with a vision. The Arabs are on board. They're all on the same page. They're willing to help. The Europeans are with us. They're willing to do this, this, and that. Everybody was on a different page. Everybody wanted something different. And so there wasn't a reason for the U.S. to say, okay, well, fine, you know, this is how we're going to do it. There was an election underway, and we're going back to domestic considerations. The president didn't want to, as far as I can tell, get involved in another war in another Muslim country. And Clinton simply didn't have enough to tip the balance in that direction. And I think that the debate that we've seen play out here, or that we've seen reported now about what was going on within the administration in terms of arming the rebels or not, is being framed too much in black and white. I mean, I don't see it as the president have, you know, I don't see, you know, all of the president's advisors coming to him, you know, Panetta, Petraeus, and Clinton, and all saying, you know, you've got to arm the rebels, and the president on his own saying no. You know, if everybody had come to him and said, this is going to work, this is foolproof, there is a chance, we have a good plan, you know, perhaps he would have been convinced. You know, David may want to weigh in on that. But I don't think that they came to him with a lot of enthusiasm. You know, they probably said, this is one of the best options, but there are no guarantees of success, and there are a lot of potential pitfalls along the way. But one last point about Syria. I think that one of the issues that perhaps for a while blinded Clinton to what needed to be done was her desire to ensure the protection of minorities in Syria, Alawites and Christians, which in a way is a laudable thing, but it impeded some of the thinking and the decision-making because it became an overriding concern. And we can, you know, debate at length how you get the Sunnis to include the Christians and the Alawites, or get the Christians and the Alawites to reach out to the Sunnis. But there was a lot of concern that if suddenly Assad fell, you'd have, you know, the Christians and the Alawite community facing a lot of retribution, a lot of violence. Do you want to say anything on?
I think it's illustrative of the kind of challenge this administration is going to face in the Middle East on an ongoing basis, because they don't want to go in, they don't want to fight another war, they don't want messy, they're uncomfortable with unclear outcomes, and so they don't act. And in not acting, I think they've allowed a situation to deteriorate to the point that you have 70,000 dead and you have the biggest refugee crisis on the planet Earth right now, and you don't have a clear outcome. And, you know, I think we're doing more than people talk about, right? We're, you know, there's some central intelligence agency stuff going on around the side of this thing that's trying to have an impact on it. But I think this is one of those areas where you could say it was a failure of leadership in the White House, but you could also say it was a failure of diplomacy. We didn't mobilize the international community to act. We didn't take strong enough actions against the Russians, who were really undermining us around this thing. I just don't think we were terribly effective in getting the kind of pressure that might have contained this. And right now, and you know, we face a real possibility. Syria is a problem within the borders of Syria right now. But Syria could very well, very shortly, be a much bigger problem in Lebanon, in Jordan, in Iraq, possibly along the borders of Turkey, you know, et cetera, and thus be destabilizing in the context of this region. And so, you know, I guess this brings me to just one last point, and you can take the rest of these questions. You had 11 questions, so you know you can deal with those. But we can sit here now and judge. This is a very good book that it gives you a real-time perception of what was happening here. That gives you an insight into her character and the character of the team that she had around her, which, again, didn't come in with a lot of foreign policy experience in some place, and did what she did, which was read into it and become terrific. But the one thing that we know about foreign policy, just like life, I'll conclude with this. This guy came to me last year and said he was asked to give a graduation address. And he said, what should I say to these kids? I don't know why he turned to me, because possibly because I have the maturity of a teenager. But and I said, you know, the one thing that I've discovered about life is, well, there are two things. One, in every life, some good things happen and some bad things happen. And two, you don't know which is which for a long, long time. And I think that's true about foreign policy. We don't know which were the right moves and which were the wrong moves. We don't know whether the greatest, you know, the greatest achievement of the Eisenhower administration was one of omission. They didn't ratchet up the Cold War and didn't go to war with the Soviet Union and let things take their time. We need a lot more time to be able to judge these things. And that's why I think that the tone and tenor of this book is exactly the one that you need right now, which is, let me see behind the scenes. Let me understand how it worked. Time will tell how we judge them.
Yeah. Because just to pick up on something that I was saying to Amal, and then I'll go to Steve's question. I do think, however, that there wasn't a lot of debate within the White House, not a lot of open debate about what to do on Syria, because there was a desire to stay away from it as much as possible in an election year, even though there is more happening behind the scenes than we think. And there is more debate at the State Department around Hillary Clinton, who is a little bit more open in the way she holds a conversation and has people weigh in from outside. So it's a little bit less insular. And going back to your question, Steve, about, you know, Hillary Clinton's gone and Assad remains, you know, that's how it often works in countries that measure time very differently than in the U.S., where everything's on a calendar and everybody's in a hurry and everybody wants to deliver quickly. And, you know, in other countries, whether it's Iran or Afghanistan or Syria, people take the long view. I mean, the Assad family has been in power some 40 years before Bashar al-Assad. There was Hafez al-Assad. And I remember in 2003, I was in Damascus covering the Iraq war. And the Syrian authorities were tacitly but very enthusiastically encouraging fighters, Arab fighters, to go into Iraq to start fighting the Americans before even Baghdad had fallen, before Saddam Hussein had been removed from power. And it was quite a telling moment when I spoke to the spokesperson at the foreign ministry at the time, and I said, do you really think this is a good idea to be encouraging this trend of fighters going into Iraq? You're, in essence, opposing the United States when American tanks are just across the border in Iraq. And her answer was, you know, we've been here for 5,000 years before the U.S., and we will be here for 5,000 years after the U.S. And that's kind of the long view and the patience that comes into the thinking in some of those countries. About Benghazi, you know, I finished writing the book before Benghazi happened. And because of the way the publishing world works, we were only able to add a little bit of text to whatever remained in terms of blank spaces on the page. It was an absolute tragedy to lose someone like Chris, who was a friend. It is unfortunately the kind of tragedy that comes with doing diplomacy in dangerous places, and it comes with sometimes doing journalism in dangerous places. I think that the partisan nature of the political debate has obscured some of what remains unknown or what answers still need to be answered when it comes to Benghazi. But overall, and David, you may want to weigh in into this. Overall, I think it doesn't necessarily change the big picture of her legacy. It will come back to haunt her. And she has said that it was one of her deepest regrets. It will be brought back to the fore if she decides to run in 2016. The sound bites from the hearings will be used by everybody for her and against her. But overall, I think it doesn't change much to the legacy. And it didn't change so far as I can tell, the course of this administration when it comes to dealing with the Arab world. It wasn't as though they were enthusiastically going to embrace the rebels in Syria and suddenly they saw what happened in Libya and they thought, oh my God, no, we're not going to go there. That's not what happened. They were already hesitant. And just, you know, I discussed this a little bit in the book. You have to remember that it's not the first time, unfortunately, that, you know, American diplomats are a target abroad. It happened in 1983 in Beirut, and I talk about it in the book. The embassy was bombed, the marine barracks were bombed, more than 300 people lost their life, and it happened under the watch of President Reagan. And very few people in the U.S., except for the relatives of those who died in Beirut, I think my impression is that very few people in the U.S. today would immediately associate President Reagan with that moment. He was reelected afterwards. So it is important to keep an eye on the bigger picture while acknowledging that mistakes were made and that a terrible tragedy happened.
Well, thank you so much, Kim. She's going to be signing books
I am?
Out there. Okay. Yeah. And thank you all for coming. Thank you to David as well.
Thank you.